This week on Daiwa, we're in Kossuth County. The wife of the former church organist is found lying in a pool of blood.
Welcome to Daiwa, the first Iowa-focused true crime podcast, where there's 99 counties and a murder in every one. These are your hosts, Beth LaValle and Allie Tulin.
All right, Kossuth County this week, Allie.
We're back in northern Iowa. Have you been?
I have been. More family in this area. Mm. And, been there a couple times.
Any fun facts?
I have one later, but it's not very fun.
Okay.
And nothing crazy from me. I'm sorry. It's boring.
Okay, well, I think I can say Kossuth County would be like my grandma's favorite Iowa fun fact.
That's fun.
Yes. Have you heard of the Grotto of Redemption?
I have.
Oh.
That, I didn't want to steal your glory, you know, and like ruin your fun fact. But this is my one fun fact that I know about Kossuth County. I'm excited for you to explain it.
Should we switch?
No. It's your grandma's favorite place.
It's true. All right. Well, I will tell the listeners. So there was a priest called Father Paul Matthias Dauberstein, and it was said while he was a young seminarian, he came down with pneumonia and was maybe going to die. But he fought it off, and while he did, he prayed to Mary and promised to build a shrine in her honor. And so he lived, and he finished his studies, and he was eventually assigned in the parishes in West Bend, Iowa. And in his spare time, he held true to his promise, and he started collecting rocks and precious stones, and eventually designed this grotto in 1912, and continued to work on it for 42 years until he died. The whole grotto is about the size of a city block and contains more than 250 types of semi-precious stones, things like amethyst and druzy quartz.
Yeah, I don't know that type of quartz, but I believe you.
Thank you. Then there's also a few things like Iowa State rocks in there, like geodes.
Love geodes.
Yeah. But now you can go to West Bend and visit this grotto. And the Iowa Magazine has called it, quote, a miracle in stone. And it's supposedly the largest man-made grotto in the world. So there's my fun fact.
See, and I didn't know that much about it. So
have you been to the grotto?
I probably have, but I don't think I remember it.
Okay.
And I definitely need to go back. It's one of my dad's like favorite places in Iowa, I think. So my dad and your grandma would get along very well.
I could see it. Well, tell me about your fact, since it's not fun.
It's not very fun, but it's from Algona, Iowa. So did you know that Algona was home to a prisoner of war camp during World War II?
I actually did know this.
So from 1944 to 1945, over 10,000 German prisoners were there. On average, there were a little over 3,000 prisoners housed at one time. Prisoners of war were usually kept in England, but the growing number caused the U.S. to build over 155 camps. So 287 acres were purchased outside of Algona, and we're not really sure why Algona was picked, but one cool story from the camp, also a religious theme today, is that three friends who were German prisoners of war built an almost life-size nativity scene with over 65 figures and donated it to the town of Algona.
Very cool. I have another fun fact about that prisoner of war camp. Are you ready for it?
I'm a little scared, if I'm being honest.
Don't be scared. This is actually related to a comedian.
Okay, I'll take it.
Chelsea Handler's grandfather was a prisoner of war at that Algona camp.
Wait, why would he be a prisoner of war?
Because he was German. Crazy.
Chelsea Handler's grandfather was a Nazi?
Yeah, I think she addressed it on like a show. I'm blanking on the name of the show, but I think I've discussed this with Taps before, actually, because, you know, he's super into the military stuff.
Oh, I thought you were going to say pop culture.
Oh. He's a huge Chelsea Handler fan. I'm sure when we ask him what his fun fact about Kossuth County is, he will say this.
All right. Let's put money on
it. $5. All right, but...
That is crazy. That's a good fun fact. Yeah. Like an actual fun fact.
It is an actual fun fact. But let's get to our murder. It's 1921. Woodrow Wilson is president, but Warren G. Harding will take office in March of 1921. The radio station WOC was started in Davenport, Iowa, and is the first commercial radio station in the state. Eggs cost around 35 cents for a dozen. And actress and future First Lady Nancy Reagan is born in New York.
Good year.
Good year.
So in Algona, Iowa, on the evening of January 15th, 1921, Minnie Benjamin was found lying in a pool of her blood on her kitchen floor. Minnie was an accomplished woman. She was a little over 50. She was a college graduate and worked as a secretary for different clubs, lodges, and the Red Cross. She had been married to Leonard T. Benjamin for 30 years, and they had three children. Leonard was a music professor and worked in the Congressional Church as an organist.
The Upper Des Moines Republican reported that rumors were spread about Leonard having an affair with a younger music student in her 30s. When that word had gotten around town, Leonard lost the majority of his music students. Also, Minnie had threatened a divorce, and one paper even said that they had met with a lawyer the previous year. Because Leonard had lost almost all of his income, with students quitting their lessons, the Benjamins had to move into a smaller house on the west end of State Street in Algona. And to make things even worse, after 15 years of being the church organist, Leonard was asked to resign. He resigned January 1st of 1921. But Leonard quickly found a job in Chicago, and arrangements were made for him and Minnie to move on Monday, January 17th.
According to Leonard, here's what took place that Saturday night before the planned move to Chicago. On Saturday afternoon, Minnie attended a bridge party with friends. She met Leonard in town that evening to buy groceries for supper and breakfast. When they got home, Leonard fixed a fire in the kitchen stove. When Leonard went outside to collect more coal, Minnie had gone to the mailbox and opened a letter addressed to Leonard. It was said after reading it, she threw it in the fire, became angry, and started a fight with Leonard. Leonard claimed he did not know what the letter said. He did say this upset everything. He lost control, picked up a hammer, and struck Minnie with a fatal blow.
After striking Minnie with that fatal blow, Leonard decided he was going to deny the whole thing happened. He left the house and visited several businesses. At the candy kitchen, he called for Miss Alice Moline, who was engaged to his son Paul. Alice accompanied Leonard back to the Benjamin home. She noticed that the house was dark and thought it was strange, and when they came in and turned the lights on, they found Minnie in a pool of blood on the floor. Leonard then knelt down and felt for a pulse and put his ear over her heart. He told Alice, quote, "I believe Mrs. Benjamin is dead."
Leonard and Alice ran to the neighbors where they called a Dr. Hartman. The doctor said Minnie had been dead for at least 30 minutes. The coroner and a jury determined a murder had been committed, and they believed Leonard Benjamin was guilty. However, Leonard was a little dumb. The coroner had noticed a number of blood stains on Leonard's clothing, but Leonard said this had happened while checking for Minnie's pulse. But he had been wearing an overcoat when that happened, and the blood stains were on his shirt sleeve that would have been covered by the coat.
The coroner found four holes in Minnie's head from the hammer, and her clothes were spread in a way that suggested another crime was committed. I'm guessing that's the old newspaper way of saying it looked like she had been assaulted or raped.
Mm-hmm.
There was also a gash on top of her head that looked like it was maybe from an axe, and her body was bruised and suggested she had been kicked.
Yikes.
Yeah.
The local paper suggested two motives. The first being that Leonard was in love with another woman and wanted his wife out of the picture. The second motive was that Leonard wanted to collect the life insurance he had on Minnie.
Minnie's funeral was on Tuesday, January 18th at the Congressional Church. Her children were all there. Her sons, Paul and Ralph, refused to make a statement to the press, but her son-in-law, E.D. McDade, was reported to be active in helping county officials get to the truth. Leonard had requested to attend Minnie's funeral, but was denied. No one mentioned the murder. Instead, they focused on how Minnie was dedicated to her work at the church, in the Red Cross during the war, and her love for humanity.
At this time, Leonard was still denying he had murdered Minnie. It was said he looked haggard and dejected. He didn't even have an alibi, but kept up the denial for 10 days. Finally, his kids had gone to visit him in jail, and perhaps had some influence in getting the confession out of him.
On February 1st, Leonard Benjamin was sentenced to 50 years of hard labor at Fort Madison Penitentiary, by Judge F.D. Coyle. The other woman, Helen Stephen, who Leonard was having an affair with, confessed to the affair in her affidavit. She said her and Leonard had planned to be married after Leonard and Minnie's son, Ralph, finished high school in 1919.
A group of citizens watched him board the train for Fort Madison with the sheriff. He was reportedly calm and said nothing to the crowd. He did tell the sheriff, quote, "I want to get away, away from all of this. The surroundings, the people, the locality seem to bring horrible memories to me." It was also reported, while in jail, Leonard continually mumbled prayers, asking forgiveness, and crying out his regret. He sat crying with his face buried in his hands.
So just 2 years later, Leonard Benjamin dies on April 21st of 1923. He had an operation about a month before and, while recovering, suffered a severe heart attack. He was buried in the prison cemetery.
Also in 1923, Minnie and Leonard's kids created a suit to collect $1,000 on the life insurance policy that Minnie had. The kids claimed they were entitled to receive the money on the policy since their father could not. The Iowa Supreme Court held that a husband who kills his wife has no right to insurance money paid out on her life.
Minnie and Leonard's children all left the Algona area. Their youngest son, Ralph, died in Portland, Oregon, just 10 years after his mother's murder. He left behind a wife and one son. Paul Benjamin married Alice Moline, and they moved down to Florida and had two daughters. And Minnie's daughter, Mary, had married Edward McDade, and they also moved down to Florida and had a son and a daughter.
Happy to hear the Floridians are doing okay.
Yeah.
But sad story. Are you ready to call taps for this one?
I am ready to call taps. I do just want to point out that we've had quite a few murders involving music men in Iowa, and I think it's a very weird coincidence.
I hope it's not any correlation.
I know. But yes, let's give taps a call.
Hi, Taps.
Nice. How's it going?
See you.
Hello.
All right. Have you been to Kossuth County?
I have been to the largest county in Iowa by landmass, Kossuth County.
We didn't even cover that one.
That's a great fun fact.
Are you Wikipediaing these counties?
No, I've been to Kossuth County and its capital, county seat, Algona, many times, home of one of the largest POW camps. In World War II, they also made a nativity set out of wood, carved it, the German soldiers did.
We covered this.
One of the prisoners is a relative of the comedian Chelsea Handler.
Beth owes me $5.
Yeah. Yeah.
I told her I knew you knew this fun fact and that you would for sure say it.
I mean, it's a good fun fact. I'm not mad about it at all. Happily owe the $5.
Love it.
Random question. We are somehow referring to this case as the Music Man case. I don't really know how that happened. It's just because he's an organist, I guess. But have you seen the Music Man?
I have seen the Music Man, but the Music Man would have been set in Cerro Gordo County, not in Kossuth County.
I couldn't remember if we covered that already or not. Cool.
I don't know, but this is, I want to say this is like our third Iowa Music Man murder case. I think there's a weird coincidence.
You think music people may be high strung?
Oh.
Wow.
Wow.
Talk about comedians. Let's get you in touch with Chelsea Handler.
Oh my God. All right. Getting serious. So when Leonard killed his wife, Minnie, he just kind of either went into denial or was acting. Do you think that denial is the most typical response from a murder?
Almost universal. Very few people admit to the crime immediately.
But even to themselves, like I feel like based on how this story was told, it was almost like he was denying it himself to himself, even like he couldn't grasp that he had done that.
I'm not a psychologist or a psychiatrist, but there's evidence that sometimes people suffer such a traumatic event that they push it to the back of their brain and don't want to think about it or have some kind of selective amnesia about it. But I favor that most people remember what they did.
Right.
Isn't denial also the first stage of grief?
Yeah.
So could this be a response to grief as well?
I mean, I guess I've never thought of it that way because to me, the denial is always the denial that they're not really dead yet. And I would guess if you smack somebody in the head with a hammer a number of times, you pretty much knew they were dead.
Yeah.
I guess I've never experienced the stages of grief, but I assume when they say denial, they mean they don't really believe that they're dead, or they would like to believe that they're alive.
No, I think that's true.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Any ideas on the average confession time for someone in custody?
No. And I mean, it's been the subject of Supreme Court cases and local court cases. And, you know, when is too long? When does it become where Fourth and Fifth Amendment rights are being abused? You know, there are stories of interrogations that have gone a day or two. I believe in today's criminal justice system, it would be difficult to sustain a prolonged interrogation without having some kind of legal jeopardy attached to it. So, I mean, certainly 8 hours, 10 hours, I could see that. But beyond 10 or 12 hours, I think you're really running into a problem. And of course, it also depends on the suspect. Will they invoke their attorney rights at some point? Were their denials strong enough that they're not budging off their denials? I mean, if you go to like the Reed School of Interrogation and places like that, you attempt to try to work off their denials and try to figure out if the denials are strong enough or if they're trying to couch them in some way. But I just think long, prolonged interrogation probably doesn't occur that much anymore.
Are there any interrogation tactics that you don't agree with, I guess?
Well, the Supreme Court says that the interrogator, if they're law enforcement, can lie to the suspects in an attempt to get a confession. And that's been very controversial for a long, long time. So that's an issue. But anything inhumane or even denial of like a bathroom or a drink or things like that, those things are all falling into Fourth, Fifth, Sixth Amendment issues now that I got to believe most officers, most law enforcement would not participate in anything like that. I mean, it's just, you're risking the entire case when you do things like that.
So like the defense lawyer could bring that up if they're on trial. Oh,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, and it'd even be brought up before trial. They'd bring it up in a motion in limine or a suppression hearing where they believe that the defendant's rights have been violated and just have the judge rule, because those are rulings made to the judge, not to a jury. And the judge would either rule on that before trial. So you'd have those pretrial motions dealt with before you ever got in front of a jury.
Leonard Benjamin was sentenced to 50 years of hard labor. One, is hard labor still a thing that you can give somebody?
Not really. The Eighth Amendment says there will be no cruel and unusual punishment. There's still some like work crews and stuff, but even the old work crews in the South and stuff have been pretty much done away with. Most of the work crews or whatever, or prison industry stuff that you see now is all voluntary, where the prisoners want to go do it because it gives them something to do during the day. But hard labor hasn't been discussed for probably more than 50 years.
What was hard labor?
You go to a prison and you work all day long, breaking rocks or doing something stupid that just causes you to work hard.
But isn't that still around in the form of you get paid an extremely low wage?
Yeah, if you work in the prison industries and stuff, you don't get paid that well. And the courts can take some of that money for victim restitution or room and board. But if you talk to inmates, most of them will tell you they're not working for the wage. They're working for something to get up and do every day. Because spending dead time for months and years is very difficult to do.
Hmm. Yeah. Do you think that was a weird sentence? 50 years of hard labor for like an older guy who killed his wife?
No, probably not then. That was probably a second degree murder charge and probably a fairly common sentence.
What do you think of the kid's petition to get life insurance money?
It's a little bit like a math equation. You have to figure out the first part of the equation before you can get to the second part. So I would assume, and I'm just assuming, that in the policy, there was some kind of fraud in the inducement or something like that in the contract that said, if he committed some fraud that caused the death or committed some crime that caused the death, that he was ineligible for the insurance policy. And because he's ineligible, then it can't pass through him to his heirs. So it makes sense to me that they wouldn't be able to get it.
Yeah. So the kids just didn't read the fine print.
Right. Insurance is all contract law, so you just read the contract.
Any other thoughts on life insurance? Is it a scam? Is it, shouldn't you be skeptical of it?
Again, I'm not a money manager kind of guy, but I've always heard and believed in the premise that you should have life insurance if somebody that you are responsible for will need money if something happens to you.
That makes sense.
Yeah, I'm on board with that.
And there's some tax consequences too. Life insurance, it's fairly preferable taxing when it passes between a decedent and down to their heirs. So lots of people buy life insurance just to pass money in their estate without having to pay estate taxes.
If you were getting married to someone, should you be skeptical if they want life insurance right away?
That might be a question you might want to kind of mull in your brain for a little bit.
Okay.
This has nothing to do with murder. I'm so sorry, but like, would there be any reason to do the opposite? Like get life insurance policies on your kids?
Well, I mean, there's some people that will get small term life policies on children just because funerals and burials cost lots of money. So they might hold a $10,000 or $20,000 policy on a child or whatever. But the most common thing is obviously the parents having fairly substantial life insurance to pay for their kids if something happens to the parents, especially in simultaneous death, like a plane crash or a car crash or something like that.
Okay.
Any final thoughts on Mini Benjamin?
No, I'm just a little curious about all these music dudes and deaths.
Right.
Now you have me thinking.
There's something there.
All right. Well, thanks as always for joining us.
Thank you.
Oh, hello there. As a marketer, I hate promotions like this.
Same and same.
But I love content.
Me too.
So if you like our content, give us a like, follow, share, subscribe, note, fax, literally anything you think would help us continue making Daiwa a success.
Thank you, thank you, thank you.